Dear listeners, before we start this episode, a quick word from our sponsors, DW, Deutsche Welle. In a country like ours, the pressure from our parents and those around us can often affect our decisions. Our dreams can often take a back seat. Though there are a few among us who dare to ask, what if I followed my dreams instead? Tune into the second season of DW's show, Choices, Dare to Dream, where six individuals meet their role models and turn their dream into reality. Like Avanti, an architect who turns to Pooja Dhingra to become a pastry chef. Or Satwik, who balances his social media career with his dreams of becoming a magician with the help of Karan Singh. To know if Satwik and Avanti could turn their dreams into reality, click on the link in the description to watch DW Choices, currently streaming on Jio Cinema. Don't miss out and remember, dare to dream. Now on with the show. Hi, I'm Rahil Philippos and you are listening to Three Things, the Indian Express News Show. In this episode, we talk about the World Health Organization's report on the global prevalence and dangers of hypertension. We also talk about Mithun, an animal that can only be found in a few states in the Northeast and has now been designated as food animal by the Food Safety and Standards Authority of India. But first, we talk about the India-Canada row. Tensions between the two countries have dramatically escalated since Justin Trudeau made explosive allegations on Tuesday that the Indian government agents are potentially linked with the killing of a pro-Khalistan separatist leader, Hardeep Singh Nijjar, who had been a Canadian citizen. Now, the Indian government had denied these allegations, calling them absurd and motivated, and both the countries had expelled each other's diplomats, starting with Canada. But yesterday, taking a hard stance and escalating the situation further, India stopped its visa services in Canada. To talk about this latest development, my colleague Shashank Bhargav speaks to the Indian Express's national diplomatic editor, Shubhajit Roy.
Shubhajit, on Thursday, India stopped visa services in Canada. Could you begin by telling us what this would mean for people in Canada who are looking to come to India?
Well, you see, you know, it's something that will impact a lot of people who would want to come to India. And these are basically Canadian citizens. And just to clarify, you know, so visa services have been suspended, which essentially means from today onwards, the Indian High Commission and the consulates won't be issuing any visas to Canadian citizens, whether they are located in Canada or if Canadian citizens apply from anywhere else in the world. So, for example, if a Canadian passport holder, he or she applies for a visa, Indian visa, in London or in New York or in Italy or in Australia, they will not be issued a visa. So that's a hard sort of a stance against people who want to come to India. So who are the people who will be affected? Mostly it would be tourists, then there would be business travelers, and also could be professionals, students who want to study here, and also a lot of people might have family here. So as you know that India has a huge diaspora, Indian diaspora in Canada, and they're married to, say, you know, family of a Canadian. So if they want to travel to India to meet their Indian family members, they won't be able to travel unless they already have a long-term visa on their passport or they have a OCI card, Overseas Citizens of India card.
Right. And these OCI cards, we understand, are long-term visas in a way. They allow Canadian citizens of Indian origin to travel back to India easily. And what you're saying is those people won't be affected that much.
So what happens is mostly people who have migrated in the recent years, they would still have a Canadian passport and a OCI card. But what happens is usually second or third generation in such families may not have an OCI card. They may just have a Canadian passport. So they will be impacted. Similarly, if one is married to a family where the in-laws are Canadian passport holders, so they may not have a long-term visa, they might be affected. So these are the kind of people, because of these years of migration and familial connections, there is a large part of Canadian passport holders who may have linkages with India, so they will be impacted.
And so do we have a rough estimate about how many people will be impacted by this move?
It's very hard to estimate that, Shashank, but there are about 17 lakh, say, people of Indian origin in Canada. And out of that, 7 lakh are NRIs. So they are basically Indian passport holders. But so, for example, it will easily be a couple of lakhs who or more who might be Canadian passport holders and may not have an OCI card or a long-term visa.
And Shubhajit, as things stand right now, and we are talking on Thursday night, does this move also affect Indians who are looking to go to Canada?
So as of now, it doesn't impact directly. So the Canadian High Commission has made it clear that it's open, it's operational with visa services. It has not taken a reciprocal action diplomatically as of now. But, you know, there is one development that has happened. That is that India has asked for cutting down of Canadian diplomatic staff in India, based in India. Basically, India's argument is there are many more Canadian diplomats, Canadian diplomatic staff in India than there are Indian diplomats and Indian diplomatic staff in Canada. So they've asked for parity. So that would mean there will be a sizable reduction in Canadian diplomatic presence in India. Now, what happens is if there is a cut in staff, so then the processing for visas, for example, those sections, those departments might be impacted. So if there is a shortage of staff there, then when one applies for a visa, then the waiting times would increase. So in that kind of a sense, it might have a snowball effect for visa waiting durations, which anyways are quite long right now after the pandemic, but it might be impacted and might get longer with this kind of a move.
And what do you think this response by India tells us about the current situation between the two countries?
So obviously, the Indian political establishment, diplomatic establishment is taking a very hard line. It has hardened its position 2 days after the Canadian Prime Minister has made this explosive allegation that, you know, that Canadian security agencies are actively pursuing credible allegations of a potential link between agents of Government of India and the killing of Hardeep Singh Najjar, who was a pro-Khalistan leader in Canada. He was a Canadian citizen. So India has taken a very strong sort of response to that particular allegation. It has obviously rejected that allegation, saying that it's absurd, it's motivated and all of that. But it has also taken some of these concrete steps. So this is in diplomatic language, it's an escalation in diplomatic countermeasures to drive home the point that India is angry, India is upset with this kind of an allegation, linking the Indian government with a killing of a pro-Khalistan leader in Canada.
And Shubhajit, you mentioned that Justin Trudeau, in his statement, said that they have credible allegations about the links between the Indian government and the killing of Najjar. But has he provided any kind of evidence to support these claims?
So he has not yet presented any evidence so far in the public domain. But he has also said that asked India to cooperate in the investigation. And India has so far not mentioned anything. But today, when asked, the MEA spokesperson said that if they're given specific information, then they will look into it. So that is, I think, the first step, I mean, window, incremental step. India has sort of signaled that it is willing to look at if there is any concrete or specific information. And mind you, yesterday, the American government, U.S. administration, it clearly sort of said, I mean, encouraged and urged India to cooperate in the probe. So that is the current situation. So we have to see what that investigation leads to and what kind of evidence is produced or shared, or whether that conclusively establishes Indian government's complicity in the killing.
Also, Shubhajit, these tensions, this escalation of situation is happening within days of the G20 summit, where top leaders from around the world had come to New Delhi. And since then, the government basically has been projecting it as a success. Do these tensions with Canada sort of put a dent in that image?
Well, you know, when Prime Minister of a country makes an allegation that another country, in this case, Canada, had made the allegations against India, that India is involved or a sort of there's a potential link as or of a link between the Indian government and the killing of a pro-Khalistan leader who's a Canadian citizen, he's talked about an extrajudicial killing. So that's a very serious charge to be made. So obviously, we don't know the facts yet. We have to wait for that. But if that turns out to be true, it has a reputational cost for India. Right now, India has obviously taken a much more harder stand, and it has hit back saying that if there is any reputational cost, it is for Canada. Canada is giving a safe haven for terrorists, to extremists, and to organized crime. So these are very harsh words. You know, usually we have never seen India use such description for a Western country, that to Canada. You know, usually such expressions, such epithets are reserved for Pakistan and Afghanistan. So that to me is a really escalation of the rhetoric, as well as sort of it shows that how both sides, I mean, India is sort of hardening its position and using a diplomatic language which is normally not used between countries which are strategic partners or which are cooperating at the international level.
And Shubhajit, apart from people traveling between these two countries, there are also fears that trade might get affected between India and Canada. Could you give a sense to our listeners about how this will impact these two nations?
Well, you know, because of the Khalistan issue having plagued in the last 5, 7, 8 years, especially during Trudeau government's regime, the trade did not really flourish in the way that it could. It's still really at about $11 billion, which is far below the potential, you know, with US, which is next door neighbor of Canada, it's $100 billion. So, you know, if you see really the size of the pie is really small. But, you know, there are things that India imports. For example, India imports a lot of pulses. So essentially, the dal you and I eat, the India consumes so much of dal that it doesn't grow as much dal as we consume. So it imports from two major source countries are Canada and Myanmar. And Canada, if this impacts, if there are tariff barriers come up or there are such import barriers come up, then that supply might be affected and that might lead to a scarcity or one has to look for alternative sources. So that might be affected. Similarly, you know, there are consumer items. For example, this McCain frozen foods, you know, McCain's frozen food. I don't know if you have them or not, but I always have them in my fridge, you know, about these frozen food, say nuggets and all those things. So if there are, again, issues in business, barriers and all of that, then these also supply chain might be impacted. We don't know yet what those steps will be taken, but usually such things have an impact. Also investments, you know, if a country decides that, you know, this country is not favorable politically to me, so then the business of that country doesn't invest in your country. So in this case, Canadian investors might not invest in India. You know, so these are the ways in which it might play out, get impacted. So we'll have to see how that develops.
And Shubhajit, do we know how this story has played out in Canada and how Trudeau's political rivals back home have responded to this?
So Trudeau's political rivals have so far been supportive of his demand. But we have seen his principal opposition leader, Poilievre, he has asked for more facts to be shared so that, you know, they're aware of what are the kind of evidence that they have. So essentially, it's ultimately boiling down to the quality of the evidence and the credibility of that evidence that the Canadian government has so far, based on which it has made these allegations. And till that comes out, we wouldn't be able to assess what happens next.
And next, we talk about hypertension. This week, the World Health Organization released a report on the global prevalence and dangers of hypertension. It's crucial to note that this is the first time that the World Health Organization has released a report on what they refer to as a silent killer. When we asked the Indian Express's Anona Dutt about the reasons behind WHO's focus on this condition, she told us that hypertension has been on the rise among people worldwide.
So globally, if you see, there is an increasing trend in hypertension. In India also, what we've seen over the years, there is a rise in hypertension, diabetes and other non-communicable diseases. That is probably the reason they have come out with this report, where they not only look at the estimated number of people who have the condition, but they are also looking at, you know, how that has affected. So, for example, they are looking at the number of strokes that this hypertension has caused, number of heart attacks caused by the hypertension, and number of deaths caused by the hypertension. So they have looked at the impact of the disease on the population.
According to the report, we can potentially prevent at least 4.6 million deaths in the country by 2040 if only half of the individuals with hypertension can successfully manage to keep their blood pressure under control. The report also highlights the reasons for and the impact of hypertension on an individual. So to know more about it and what measures one can take to manage the condition, my colleague Ucha Sarman speaks to Anona in this segment.
So Anona, can you first tell us what the report says about how bad is the situation in India?
So the estimate that has been given by this WHO report is quite conservative as compared to some of the estimates given by researchers from our own country. But what the WHO report says is about 188 million people are currently living with this condition, and only 37% of the people who have this condition are actually getting diagnosed. That means like over 60% of the people don't even know that they have hypertension. And even after knowing, a lot of people do not get on treatment because they feel fine. That is something our doctors have been reporting, that a lot of people ignore treatment because hypertension per se does not have symptoms until and unless you get some complications because of it. The report says that only 30% of the estimated number of people who have hypertension actually get the treatment, and only 15% have their hypertension under control. However, if we look at one of the biggest studies from India called INDIAB, which has a very representative sample, that had actually projected that about 315 million people in the country live with hypertension. So the WHO estimates are conservative as compared to that.
Right, and the WHO report and even the Indian reports that you have mentioned, do they talk about why hypertension is so prevalent in India?
So prevalence of hypertension in India or elsewhere is quite the same. It's a lifestyle disease. So people not eating healthy, people not exercising enough, not sleeping properly, being stressed out, having alcohol, smoking, all of this increases the risk for hypertension. And of course, there is also a genetic component to it. So if your parents, for example, have had hypertension, then you're more likely to have it. So then you have to work on your risk factors and reduce it. One of the easiest interventions, as the expert said, is reducing your salt intake. Salt has been directly linked to hypertension, and cutting the salt can actually help control hypertension in people who have it. So that is one of the best ways to go about it. WHO says that you can consume about 2 grams of salt in a day, and the average Indian consumes about 10 grams.
Right, so this is a lifestyle disease. But apart from, say, controlling what we eat, do we know if anything else can be done to manage hypertension?
Right. So the first point is screening. Now, for a disease like hypertension, screening becomes extremely important because, as I said earlier, hypertension does not have any symptoms. So you might be living with the condition and not be aware of it at all till, say, for example, your kidney gets damaged and you end up in a hospital. Or you end up in a hospital with severe headaches because of it. Or, I mean, you could have a heart attack, stroke, and that's when you get diagnosed with hypertension. But all of this damage that has been done to your body, that cannot be reversed. So it is just better if people undergo screening, get a diagnosis, and then start a treatment. So for screening, most doctors say that, you know, by your late 20s, early 30s, you should start checking your blood pressure. Dr. Yadav, who's a cardiologist from AIMS, he said that, you know, every 10 years from the time, say, you're 25, 30, just keep testing your blood pressure. And if you have turned 50, then you have to do that every 5 years. But this means only in healthy individuals, in people who've already been diagnosed with hypertension, they have to take the pills for the rest of their lives, most likely. And it's not just taking the same pill for the rest of the life. You have to consult regularly with your doctor to adjust the dosages so that your hypertension remains in control. So, for example, if you have hypertension, you should ideally go to your doctor at least 3 to 4 times a year and get your dosages checked. This will help in keeping it in control. And there's also a need to create this awareness that hypertension might not manifest as a symptom. So even if you feel that you're perfectly fine, you should still go get screened and you should still take the medicine. Don't wait for yourself to not be fine.
Right. And Anuna, for this, we understand that the India Hypertension Control Initiative has made certain efforts to address this problem. So tell us about the kind of interventions they have made.
So the India Hypertension Control Initiative, I think, was started somewhere around 2017 with an aim to, again, screen people and put them on treatment. So screen people how? Screen people in the whoever is coming to the primary healthcare centers, hospitals, etc. You have to get them tested and maintain a database of these people, give them treatment and keep a follow-up on the people that they're taking the treatment. So that was the whole initiative. And the WHO report now says about 5.8 million people from 27 states have already been added to this initiative. Other than that, the government is also making a lot of effort through their Ayushman Bharat health and wellness centers. There are over 1.5 lakh health and wellness centers in the country, and they have been asked to focus on non-communicable diseases. So anybody who's going to these centers will be screened for these most common diseases.
And in the end, we talk about an animal that can only be found in a few states in the Northeast. The animal in question, which bears a striking resemblance to cows, is called Mithun and has now been designated as food animal by FSSAI, the Food Safety and Standards Authority of India.
So a Mithun is essentially a large bovine animal, which is, you know, the family of cows, buffaloes and so on.
That is the Indian Express's Sukrita Barua, who covers Northeast for the paper, and she says that Mithun is a very unique species.
In India, it's found in just 4 states, which is Nagaland, Arunachal Pradesh, Mizoram and Manipur. So this is a species that stays in hilly terrain. So in this kind of like Himalayan terrain it occupies.
In fact, when Sukrita spoke to Dr. Abhijit Mitra, who is the Animal Husbandry Commissioner with the Union Government and an expert on Mithun, he informed her that the animals are very well dressed.
You know, I had a really long discussion with Dr. Abhijit Mitra. So he used to be the director of this ICAR Center for Research on Mithun, which is located in Nagaland. And he is just fascinated with the Mithun. So, you know, when he was talking to me about, you know, why he's fascinated with the animal, one of the first things he said was like, you know, I've never seen an animal which is so dress sensitive. You know, they're all wearing black coats with, you know, white socks and they perfectly turned out always.
Now, Mithun is a culturally significant animal in the regions where it is found. And according to Sukrita, these animals also possess significant economic value.
You know, traditional economic value, and it has been used in, say, bartering in the regions. Say, in Arunachal Pradesh, it's also used in weddings as like bride price. It's also has a lot of ritual significance. So sacrifices during important festivals, weddings, and in recent times, because it's so prestigious, it's also used in elections, you know, for feasts thrown by candidates. And it's incredibly valuable, like I said. So, for example, an adult Mithun that's 4 to 5 years of age, you know, when sold for when there's going to be a sacrifice or something, it can be sold for up to 2 lakhs. So that gives us a sense of how valuable this animal is in the regions where it's found.
And here Sukrita recounts that Dr. Mitra, while highlighting the cultural significance of the animal, told her a story that involved Mithuns, a tribal chief, the former Prime Minister Jawaharlal Nehru, and a marriage proposal.
It goes that when Prime Minister Nehru had come for a visit to Arunachal Pradesh, he was greeted by a tribal chief. And the chief had made an offer to him. And he said, ki, you know, I'm giving you 500 mithuns. 500 mithuns. Keep in mind, I said that one mithun's value right now is 2 lakh rupees. So he offered him 500 mithuns and said, you know, I'm making you this offer. And he asked for Indira Gandhi, who was a young lady back then, her hand in marriage with his son. And apparently Nehru said something like, oh, you know, how generous, but she's already promised to someone else, or something like that, something along those lines, okay? And of course, he was being respectful and understanding of just what a significant gesture this was. So what Dr. Mitra was trying to say is that, look how much value the mithun has in the society, where, you know, it's an incredibly generous offer, which only a very, very powerful man could have said. It's 500 mithuns. So who could possibly say no to this? Not even the Prime Minister. So this is one of the stories that he had told me to emphasize on the significance and value of a mithun.
Now, as we mentioned earlier, we are talking about this animal today because the FSSAI has designated it as a food animal. Sukrita tells us what exactly this means.
So the mithun is consumed. It is already eaten as food in the regions where it is found, right? It's a limited region, but it is consumed. What I understand an FSSAI tag can do is that now it opens up the path for the mithun to be marketed in and sold in and consumed in areas where it is not traditionally eaten. So, for example, the efforts that are currently on are to say, if there's a farmer who is producing mithun, then the village community can be involved in processing the meat. So you can make different products. You can have dried meat, pickles, and so on. And then market these in, say, Delhi, Calcutta, Hyderabad. So this is what opens up, you know, and then you can have that stamp, right? FSSAI approved meat. So it opens the path for the commercial sale and marketing of this meat in areas other than where it is traditionally eaten.
And here it is important to note that mithuns are semi-domesticated animals and farmers do not need to put in a lot of effort to rear these bovine. However, Sukrita said that this may change, especially now that mithun products will be commercialized for markets beyond the northeastern states.
So there's a community forest for the mithun farmers of a particular village. They let loose in the farm and they eat there, they graze there, they eat fallen leaves. And what creates a bond between a farmer and a mithun is just an offering of salt. So the farmers offer them salt and then they know that this is my person and then they lick salt off them. And they just let loose, they say. So there's, you know, what we understand as, you know, the inputs that go into rearing a farm animal is absent, right? And the mithuns which are reared by the farmers, from what I understand, it's not like, you know, they killed and then sold at a market. But the farmers I had spoken to, they have never sold mithun at a market. There's a mithun, and then if there's a festival or, say, a marriage in their village or in neighboring villages, that's when it's sold. So what could potentially change, of course, is then this can become a year-round thing. It can be something that engages more of the village community, for example, women in carrying out the processing and all of that. And it can become a more sustainable livelihood option, perhaps, you know. So it can be a different mode of earning for village communities.
But this commercialization also comes with concerns regarding their conservation, especially considering the fact that mithuns are only reared in 4 northeastern states.
The mithun is found in a very restricted area. In the last livestock census, there were around 3.9 lakh mithun, which is actually considerably more than, it's quite a big jump, apparently 30% increase since the last census. But, you know, there's a concern. If more mithun is consumed and sent out, then does that mean that we're going to be compromising on efforts to conserve or increase the population? So one of the mandates of this center, which worked towards the food tag and towards a commercial sale of meat, one of its primary mandates is the conservation of the mithun. So they don't see it at odds. They're saying if we give an economic incentive, if there's an economic incentive, it is further encouragement to mithun rearers to rear mithun, to continue rearing them and in a sustainable way. So in their view, it's not at odds with each other.
You were listening to Three Things by The Indian Express. Today's show was edited and mixed by Suresh Pawar. It was written and produced by Shashank Bhargav and Ucha Sarmin, who originally spoke to Sukrita Barua for the last segment. If you like the show, then do subscribe to us wherever you get your podcasts. You can also recommend the show to someone who you think will like it. Share it with a friend or someone in your family. It's the best way for people to get to know about us. You can also tweet us at Express Podcasts and write to us at podcast@indianexpress.com.